This is The Benson at 100, a podcast from the Nettie Lee Benson Latin American Collection at the University of Texas at Austin. The Benson is one of the world's most storied libraries. During this, our centennial year, we explore the people, archives, and collections that built this library. Learn more at benson100.org. That's benson100.org. Thanks for joining us.
And welcome to the Benson at 100 podcast. We're going to make a journey through the history of Latin America using a series of documents and objects that the public can find at the Nettie Lee Benson Library and Collections. My name is Pilar Zazueta. I'm a historian and the associate director of Lilas Benson.
And I'm Daniel Arbino. I'm the head of collection development for the Benson.
So today, Daniel and I will be discussing a document from our collection, the Decreto Número 14 of 1824. It has a kind of a boring name, but it's a very interesting document. First, Daniel, can you tell us where we can find this document at the Benson?
For sure. This item comes from the Arturo Taracena Flores collection, which the Benson acquired around 1970, right around the time that Taracena Flores passed away. It's a sizable collection whose strength is in Guatemala and contains approximately 7,000 books, 5,000 broadsides, posters, circulars, and memos are publications by the government or workers' unions or different political parties, the church and the press. Taracena Flores was an avid book and print material collector who collected items published or circulated in Guatemala and other Central American countries during the 19th and 20th centuries. And although much of the material actually centers around the mid-20th century political turmoil in Guatemala, so I'm talking about the 1944 revolution and the 1954 coup and liberation movement, today we'll actually be talking about an edict from 1824 that appears in the form of a circular.
So yes, we chose a sort of more unusual document from the collection because we're contrarians, but the document is still very interesting. But so what is this document exactly, this decree number 14?
So as you stated that at the beginning, we have here a Guatemalan government decree from 1824 that was distributed specifically to parish priests with the order to eradicate indigenous languages. The title, Decreto Número 14, Decree Number 14. This document is one page long. It consists of about six paragraphs. And as laid out by the government of Guatemala, the purpose of this document is to, and I quote here, unify the nation by making Spanish the one language spoken within it, which just seems like a bad idea to get us started. In the document, indigenous languages are referred to, and I want to stress these are the words used in the document and not my personal. The languages are referred to as incomplete, diverse, and imperfect, and thus unsuitable for perfecting their civilization or serving as a tool of enlightenment. So with this in mind, the government calls on parish priests to see to the extermination of indigenous languages among their parishioners. Parish priests should enforce this ban on indigenous languages by, and I quote, any successful method, which is super vague, so any successful method possible, and that the parishes that are successful in this campaign will be rewarded. Finally, parish priests are encouraged to copy and circulate this information for all to see because it applies to the entire nation.
So this is quite an authoritarian type of policy that they were trying to implement. And I want to discuss the broader historical context so we can understand the goal and purpose of the policy and what the document is all about a bit better.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a great idea because you have the beginning of a new nation. But Pilar, I'm sure that folks are already tiring of my voice. So I'll turn to you. What were you able to find out?
I don't think people are tiring of your voice. But I was able to find out a few things. So the first is that the edict or the decreto was produced in the immediate aftermath of the Latin American Wars of Independence. As an aside, maybe a lot of people don't know this, but Guatemala and the rest of Central America were a unified group of provinces, like a country on its own, when they became independent from Spain in 1821. This union failed. It lasted until 1839. This was a period that was very, very conflictive in the region.
Yeah, this seems like a super unstable period, not only in Central America, but the rest of the continent. You have the Wars of Independence finishing up in most places. You have the rise of the Caudillo in various parts of Latin America. The U.S. is already starting to sort of spread its tentacles and test out imperial ideas into Latin America, right? And so, yeah, super unstable at this time.
Yes, and politics in many Latin American countries, and Guatemala was no different, were characterized by a very bitter struggle between two political factions, the liberals and the conservatives. These factions in many places were made up of elite people, the political and economic elites of each of these Latin American countries.
And these elites tended to be criollos, right? So we're thinking about ethnicity right now. And criollos, people of Spanish or European origin, and then also Ladinos, which I have learned has a very specific meaning in this context. I say that because I first learned the word Ladino in a course when I was a grad student that talked about enclaves of Sephardic communities in the Americas, like New Mexico. And so for me, I my mind immediately went to like this type of Judeo-Spanish language. But to be clear, that's not at all the case here, right? So how is Ladino used in Guatemala?
Yes, it was confusing for me too, because in Mexico, the meaning of the word is completely different. So unlike Mexico and other places, post-independence Guatemala did not emphasize the concept of mestizaje, of the mixing of cultures and people. Ladino in Guatemala refers exclusively to European identity. One conceit of Guatemalan nationalism is that indigenous people would become Ladinos by giving up the cultural traits that mark their ethnicity and their community. So one of the people who has studied the process of quote-unquote assimilation or Ladinoization in Guatemala is actually historian Arturo Taracena Arriola, who is a descendant or part of the family that sold the Arturo Taracena Flores collection. And so he explains, Arturo Taracena Arriola, that the independent Guatemalan state, in fact, put into place legal mechanisms that formally were supposed to achieve Ladinoization, but the actual result was institutionalized inequality and discrimination in Guatemala.
Yeah, and I think we can like pause just for a second and think about how problematic all of this is, that you would expect a community to sort of leave behind their traits that make them a unique community and give them this idea, which is totally assimilation, and paint this as like the idea that you should strive for. Like, it's just so problematic. So, okay, we have struggles between liberals and conservatives. This is happening in the economic sector. It's happening in the political sector. It's happening specifically between elites. So what is the role of indigenous people in this intra-elite conflict?
So at first, indigenous communities stayed out of this conflict, or tried to stay out of this conflict. But the problem was that liberal policies in post-independence Guatemala weakened, or were intended to weaken, indigenous power and autonomy. So indigenous people were forced to participate in these disputes.
That was how I understood it as well. I mean, the goal of the liberals was to consolidate the nation state. They tried to strengthen the power of the central government in every region of the country. According to classical liberalism, equality and liberty should be the main political organizing values. Liberal political ideas did not really have popular support at this time, nor a real basis in reality. During the colonial era, society was not organized by a liberal conception of citizenship. In other words, individuals with rights, but restricted by social strata. Everyone belonged to a strata or class of people.
Yes, exactly. During the Spanish colonial era, the Spanish crown put in place mechanisms that separated people ethnically, culturally, and geographically. The main two ones were called the Republic of the Indians and the Republic of the Spaniards. They had their own jurisdictions. The Republic of the Indians was supposed to represent indigenous people who lived in semi-autonomous indigenous communities in rural areas. The Republic of the Spaniards that represented everyone else, meaning the descendants of Europeans, people who came directly from Europe, or the so-called castas. I'm using a colonial term, meaning people of mixed racial and ethnic origin, descendants of slaves or former slaves, people who came from Africa, Asia, but also indigenous people from the Americas. And a lot of the people who did not belong to indigenous communities, they mostly lived in cities or villages. In some parts of Latin America, like what is now Mexico, New Spain, these divisions were not as stark in practice. But in Guatemala and other places in Central America, there was many indigenous communities were really isolated from the cities. And the reason why this was is that the region was rich on natural resources, but it didn't have the economic importance for Spain that other places in the continent had. Now, the Spanish crown in the 18th century, before the movements for independence began, tried to make inroads and eliminate this space that existed between indigenous communities and the cities. Meaning, when I say space, I mean they wanted to have more control, limit some of the autonomy that the indigenous communities had gained because they were geographically remote and other reasons. So what they did, a series of reforms, the Spanish crown, called the Bourbon reforms, that had the intent of the central government having more control on the indigenous political institutions. That included the cabildos, their leaders, and also their communal organizations that were also religious, that were organized to worship local saints. These were called cofradías.
Exactly. So in some ways, the liberal project during the post-independence era was a continuation of this like Bourbonic, I think that's a word, this Bourbonic attempt of administrative centralization, which was all about extending political and economic control. Indigenous communities, as you might expect, who have been, you know, who have already felt the extent of colonialism, continue to become more and more resistant to growing intervention by the liberal governments, while liberals saw strengthening municipal governments as a vehicle to homogenize collective identities through Hispanization or Latinization.
So what were other policies that the Guatemala liberales implemented during this post-independent period?
They began plans of restructuring municipal government and passed these laws in 1836, so after the decree we're talking about, right? For example, they introduced new legislation so that in order to access municipal offices, indigenous men had to adopt Western styles of dressing, and people were even fined if they did not comply to this. So it was really, in a way, like engineering, if you will, a sort of citizen body, right? And that citizen body was very much Eurocentric or Ladino, as you pointed out.
Exactly. And this is a policy that resembles the edict that we're discussing here. It's just a different example. No, one refers to language and the other one refers to dress. And we have mentioned that in some ways, the liberal reform was a continuation of colonial initiatives, but in other ways it was not. No, so it's kind of complicated.
Absolutely. I think, you know, liberals thought indigeneity was one of the worst legacies of the colonial era. Indigenous people should not be a social sector apart from other sectors, but quote unquote modern citizens. And that brings us to the other faction, the conservatives.
Yes, the conservatives thought indigenous people had to continue under the paternalistic protection and direct control of the elite. There was no talk about modern citizenship amongst this faction. They had a very clear vision of social order based in the past and Hispanic traditions, as opposed to liberals who were more oriented towards Anglo-Saxon political culture. For conservatives, the relationship to policies was an extension of colonial times, and they also wanted to impose Spanish, the only language, but not as a mark of modernity like the liberals, but not to tradition. So, for example, and I taking this information from a book from historian Julio César Pinto Soria, José María Castilla, who was a parish priest and founding father of Guatemalan state, he participated in the struggle for independence, was a priest and a conservative, argued the following, and I'm quoting Castilla. "It is indispensable that the majority of citizens know how to read and write, learn arithmetic, Christian morals, know the Constitution, and speak in a single language. Indigenous people and Spanish people should speak in the same language and have the same rudiments of civilization."
Yeah, so, you know, if I'm paring this down a little bit, Pilar, it's almost like the indigenous populations were presented with two options here. The liberal one, which is you essentially become very Ladino in your appearance and language and culture, or you know, the conservative route was you get treated sort of like, you know, it's so patriarchal and it's so condescending that you're almost treated like a child. I mean, is that how you see it as well?
Exactly. And people were very unhappy about these new policies, and this led to widespread discontent. And there were people who capitalized on this discontent. The most important example is the leadership of José Rafael Carrera, who was a military man, a Ladino mestizo landowner. He was known as El Indio Carrera by his enemies, so they were not calling him a Ladino, they were calling him an indigenous person, and this was supposed to be an insult. He, Carrera, led a massive uprising of indigenous people and the castas, meaning the people from different mixed ethnic origins in southern and eastern Guatemala. They were fighting against liberal government policies. Carrera and his followers rebelled against anti-clericalism, the privileges the liberal government gave to foreign land investors, land encroachment by some of these investors, supposed investors, and some of the Creole elites. And also the people who followed Carrera or supported Carrera were also unhappy with the liberal education policies, including some that banned the use of indigenous dress and indigenous language. Another factor that led to Carrera's success was that during that time period, there was a cholera epidemic in Guatemala. And these epidemics were devastating to many communities, and people didn't know how the disease spread. So there were a lot of rumors flying around, and the government policies were not very effective. And this, in turn, also created animosity towards the liberal government in Guatemala and gave more supporters to Carrera. So Carrera won in the midst of political instability, and he promulgated conservative restoration. And the political instability, unfortunately, didn't stop there. And in part, it continued. The fights between different factions of the elite were continued to be common during the second half of the 19th century. And the Carrera's success was also part of the reason why the Central American Federal Republic failed. Guatemala constituted itself as a fully independent nation.
It's so interesting, so fascinating. I mean, there's so much history here. I think I'm going to try to circle back to language and culture, because I think you and I could sit here and talk about history and have maybe a 5-hour episode on this. And so, you know, thinking a little bit about language and culture and the decree that got us started on this amazing conversation, you know, policies like the ones described in the edict were both a failure and success. I think there's something to be said for a new nation that had a chance to do things differently and valued the diversity of peoples within its republic, and yet continued down the exact same path set forth by colonialism. And it's not that I'm picking on Guatemala, because obviously the United States did the same thing. But in reference to this document, to say that you want to unify different groups, and that's the word they use, they want to unify different groups. And then to say you want to do that by exterminating an important marker of culture, which is language. I mean, that seems so counterproductive to me, so misguided. And clearly it didn't really work despite multiple and violent attempts throughout the years. I mean, this wasn't the only time.
Yes, this wasn't the only time, and it wasn't the only time that it failed. And one of the legacies of post-independent politics is the nature of a state that imagined assimilating citizens, but really ended up forcing segregation and discrimination. It also contributed to the illegitimacy of many different governments in Guatemala, and the popular mobilizations continued well into the 20th century. Obviously, the circumstances were different from mobilization, and the goals and the policies implemented later on were different, but it did create a situation where the government was not legitimate in the eyes of many people. So the communities mobilized against the government.
At the same time, it weakened indigenous languages in the 19th and 20th centuries. But we can also point to their resiliency as a marker of cultural continuity, right? I mean, these languages are still spoken today. So they may have been weakened in these moments, but they did not disappear.
No, they did not disappear. And there's also a revival, a process of revitalization going on. It started this politics and policies of revitalization started more strongly in the period of democratization after the failure of the military governments in the late 20th century in Guatemala, but they still face many challenges. So recently I had the chance to listen to Dr. Demetrio Cogti, who is an intellectual, activist, and former government official of Guatemala. His first language is Maya Cachiquel, and he has been at the forefront of these language revitalization efforts. Dr. Cogti was invited by one of our faculty members, Sergio Romero, to give a talk about what are language revitalization efforts and how do they work. And so Dr. Cogti is not only a champion of the Maya family of language, but also other languages spoken in Guatemala and Central America, like Garifuna. And one of the things he said was that maintaining vibrant language communities in multilingual societies requires a lot of effort, flexibility, and investment from civil society, but also the government. There needs to be a very strong collaboration by people, but also not only bottom up, but top down. And he also said that current and past racism and these colonialist policies that we have been talking about have obviously been devastating, but there is a path forward.
Yeah, and I'm going to take a moment just because this podcast is dedicated to the Benson and promoting the Benson. This seems like a really nice time for a shameless plug of the Benson, because I think it's really great that the Benson participates in libraries in general, but of course I'm looking at the Benson, that we participate in language revitalization initiatives. You know, all of my colleagues, we are all deeply invested in, you know, doing collection development, can aid in language revitalization efforts. We collect books in and about indigenous languages. And I, of course, want to give a shout out to the Archive of Indigenous Languages of Latin America, or ILA, which makes up a part of the Benson. This is a digital language archive that contains recordings, texts, and other multimedia materials in and about the indigenous languages of Latin America. The archive also contains a wealth of language documentation materials. I'm thinking about grammars, dictionaries, ethnographies, and field notes that can be used toward teaching materials or language revitalization programs. And best of all, you know, this is something that is completely free and only requires free registration. You just have to go online and register.
Yes, it's super easy to use, and yes, it's free, which is great. And continuing with the shameless blogs, we also have here at the University of Texas the Indigenous Language Initiative, that it's housed here at Lilas Benson, and it focuses on teaching, researching, promoting, and revitalizing indigenous languages spoken in many different parts of Latin America. So we have classes taught by experienced native speakers. And we have offered classes in Maya Quiche, Nahuatl, and Quechua. And we hope to expand our offerings in the future.
Maybe I'll see you in one of those classes, because that sounds too good to pass up.
I know, we should learn some languages.
We must learn.
Well, yes, we're not doing so well with, at least I am not doing so well with the two that I already speak.
Same.
But let's be optimistic.
Right.
We have to abandon the mindset of monolinguism,
right,
and expand our horizons,
right, or even this notion of perfecting a language. You know, we're just communicating in it, right? You know, good, bad, and everything in between.
Exactly. We shouldn't worry about our accents, about inventing words,
right,
or sounding dumb.
Right.
It's all part of the.
The learning process.
Exactly, the learning process and the joy of languages. So exactly. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you for having me. And as always, it's just a real pleasure for me to do these conversations with you. I really could just keep going with you. They're so much fun.
Yes, so we'll try again in the next episode. Let's see what other things we can find at the Benson Library. A lot of things we're going to find at the Benson Library.
Absolutely, that sounds great. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
The Benson at 100 is a production of Lilas Benson Latin American Studies and Collections at the University of Texas at Austin. To see relevant images and links for today's discussion, as well as to support the Benson Centennial, visit benson100.org. Music for this podcast was composed by Ola Ola. Thanks for tuning in.